Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much do the best and brightest of North Korea understand about the outside world? When journalist Suki Kim signed on to teach English at Pyongyang University of Science and Technology, the South Korean-born American discovered how much she was not allowed to tell her students. Talking about democracy was out, as was any acknowledgement that the pre-downloaded, pre-censored content her students could access on their computers was not the same thing as the Internet. Her co-workers at the private, evangelical-funded school were forbidden to talk about Jesus for fear they might distract students from their quasi-religious devotion to the great leader. Kim's students were at once naive and quick to lie, loyal to the regime and eager to please their American teachers, and, as she discovered, easy to care and even worry about. Suki Kim's new memoir is called Without You, There Is No Us, My Time with the Sons of North Korea's Elite. Suki, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You were born in South Korea and moved to the U.S. in your early teens, but the specter of North Korea was very much a part of your family history. Can you talk a little bit about how that has sort of driven your work trying to unlock the secrets of North Korea?
Yes, I was born and raised in South Korea, and in both sides of my family had members of the family that got lost to the North during Korean War. So I watched my grandmother missing her son until the end of her life. So I guess I was always the heartache of a mother who lost her son. He was 17 at the time. Was always with me and, you know, that whole generation, because it affected about 10 million families. The Korean War, those families got separated. And then I myself came to America at 13, so I also experienced losing home in also language to a degree. So later on, I went to North Korea for the first time in 2002 for the 60th birthday celebration of Kim Jong-il, and I ended up writing a long feature piece for New York Review of Books. But that first time, I really identified with that sense of loss, I think, when I saw North Korea for the first time.
When you talk about your grandmother losing her 17-year-old son, the family was trying to sort of flee en masse, and they were getting on a bus, and this young man said, there was some question about whether there was room for everyone, and he said, I'll get off, and I'll join you later. And he never made it.
I think those were the those heartbreaking, you know, split-second decisions that you make during war. So I think that whole family got on this car that everybody was fleeing to the south because the bombs were coming from the north. And they all got into this car. My grandmother had five children. He was the oldest. And the minute they all secured seats, somebody screamed out, you know, young men should really give up seats for women and children. So he was one of those young men who got up and said, okay, I'll get off. And then, you know, he just said, I'll get a ride. You know, I'll get another ride. I'll follow you. And then that's when Seoul, you know, they were all fleeing from Seoul, which is the capital of now South Korea. That's when Seoul was captured. So she never saw him again. But then she heard from other people that they saw him basically with his arms tied and taken away with the North Korean soldiers.
And for years, the family hoped he might still be alive, but there's never been any evidence of that.
No, there's never been any evidence. But this story is quite a common one, you know, in both South and North, because it's such a small country, and there was never any tribal relations or anything. It was just a kingdom. So everybody had somebody, you know, in a different town, right across, and you know, when the border came down, some people were just away on a business trip and the border came down and just never saw, or away at school in the other city. And I think my grandmother literally just did not understand that this border was not temporary. That was 1953 when that border came down and just never opened.
And how
so millions of people just never saw their children, their mother, their husbands and wives. I mean, I can't imagine anything worse than spending your life for 60 years waiting and missing somebody.
And it's so incredibly surreal, Suki, because there's been this really divergent evolution of these two countries since the border came down. And, you know, now South Korea is so modern and prosperous. And North Korea is just this really baffling, secretive place.
Yeah, it's almost as if they went in the opposite direction. I mean, the Korean War was really a Cold War. So it was really a war between, you know, the then Russia and the United States. So South then became almost like a protege of the United States. And North, you know, the original Kim Il-sung was really a handpicked by Russia. He was a Russian army general, actually. So although he was Korean. So you know, North Korea just went in the opposite direction, and South Korea, they basically both excelled in their, you know, whatever direction.
So I'll confess, I didn't know that anything like Pyongyang University of Science and Technology existed until I read your book. First of all, how did a school run by foreigners, and evangelical Christian foreigners at that, come to be tolerated in the capital of this fiercely communist, fiercely isolationist country like North Korea?
Well, I first started going to North Korea in 2002, for Kim Jong-un's 60th birthday celebration. I wrote a piece, and then I went to cover the New York Philharmonic in 2008 in Pyongyang. And that's when I heard about this school that's being built, which I found it really strange also. And then I soon found out that there was this group of evangelical Christians who had raised about $35 million to build a school. They've been kind of pursuing it for like 10 years. And then the school finally went up in 2010 at the end, and I went to teach there in 2011, which happened to be Kim Jong-il's final year. You know, I was there in his last 6 months of his life. But back to your point of how is a school like this possible? I mean, everyone asked that. And there are two points about that. One is because we've been hearing about those missionaries who were sent, you know, detained in North Korea, like Kenneth Bae and Jeffrey Fowle, one of whom got a 15-year sentence in, you know, hard labor in Gulag. Those are different. Those are Christians, missionaries who went into North Korea on tourist visa and began passing out Bibles, which is against the North Korean law. It's actually proselytizing is an executionable crime. This school, Pyongyang University of Science and Technology, the evangelical Christians who run this school had made some sort of an agreement with the North Korean regime that they will fund the school, build the school. Basically, almost all of the money that runs that school is coming from churches around the world. And they have made a promise not to proselytize. So they don't.
They don't proselytize, but administrators at the school have reacted pretty strongly to the book, saying that you mischaracterize them as maybe would-be missionaries. Can you tell us about what you witnessed with regard to at least their interest potentially in converting North Korean students?
Well, it is quite a problematic situation because an article came out in the Times, New York Times, about, you know, I guess they did an interview with the school's president who asked me not to publish this book when he found out that my book was coming out. And, you know, and he had claimed that now, you know, they found out that he's misrepresented as a missionary rather than evangelical Christian. But from what I observed by being in that school for 6 months, I mean, the larger goal is to convert North Koreans to Christianity. The problem with that setup, though, is that in order to get there, you know, they're pretty much shaking hands with the North Korean regime in order to do that. So as far as the North Korean regime is concerned, they don't really care what, you know, whether you're Christian or Muslim or atheist. All they know is you're not the believer of the great leader, and then you bring in a lot of money to educate their youth for free. And this particular school is only for the sons of elite. So in essentially, basically, the future leaders of North Korea are being educated by evangelical Christians. But one point I do want to make is that, you know, the president of the school is made a whole point how now they might be in danger. And that's just simply not true. It would be it's a laughable claim because North Korean government knows exactly who they are. It's just open secret because they run an almost identical school in China, which is, you know, very, very well-known missionary school. And every one of those faculty practically they have a highly missionary background.
At one point, you became really frustrated with a colleague whose attitude was toward repression in North Korea. It was essentially that, like, the suffering of the North Koreans in this life didn't really matter so much as the state of their souls in the next life.
My observation was the larger goal was about conversion to Christianity because this is a very vulnerable population. You know, it's not like passing out Bibles kind of stuff. It's really more that, you know, if they were to, North Korea were to open up one day, then, you know, they have kind of the first footing. And, you know, it's as if North Korea's absolute belief in the great leader can be replaced with Jesus. And all of that would be fine. But I think the cost of that, though, is that they, you know, they're basically feeding the regime. And North Korea has, you know, 25 million starving people under persecution. There are gulags everywhere. You know, it's a bit of an unconscionable thing to feed the regime.
What did your students have to do? You say they were the sons of the elite, but what did they have to do to be accepted into Pyongyang University of Science and Technology?
From what I understand, they were handpicked.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they just said what was fascinating, though, 2011, the last year, the final year of Kim Jong-il's life, all the universities in North Korea were shut. And all the university students were sent to construction fields under this, you know, state purpose of building a powerful and prosperous nation, which is one of their very popular slogans, except this group of 270 young men aged 19 and 20. These were the only university students who were allowed to be in school. Everybody else was in construction fields. So that would, you know, make you realize that these are creme de la creme.
Were they aware of how fortunate they were to be still in school?
You know, they were so guarded.
Mm-hmm.
So incredibly guarded. So other than discussing the English grammar, they wouldn't ever talk about anything else. But towards the end, you know, because I was, you know, none of us were allowed out. We were all in this walled compound that was guarded by the military. And, you know, I think towards the end, because we lived together purely from our proximity to each other, and, you know, I ate all my meals with them. I played sports with them. I became almost like their mother, you know, like they didn't see anybody but me pretty much. So I think by the end, they did open up, and I could tell that they would write letters. I made them write letters, and they would say, you know, I feel bad that I'm not at the construction field.
We're speaking with journalist Suki Kim about her new memoir, Without You, There Is No Us, My Time with the Sons of North Korea's Elite. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Suki Kim. Her new memoir is called Without You, There Is No Us, My Time with the Sons of North Korea's Elite. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Suki, what kind of rules did you agree to when you signed on to teach at the university?
The things that we were not allowed to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the list was very, very long. Basically, you couldn't talk about anything about the outside world. You never, ever hint there's something wrong with their country. You don't, you know, like images of the great leader, you can't like fold them or appoint to them. You never compare. You never say there are cities like this, but my city is like that, because that could be considered a slight. You never say those names because they're like deities, Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un, and Kim Il-sung. So basically, you weren't really allowed to do anything except talking about the great grammar.
And when you say that they're treated like deities, this is something that is so hard, you know, coming from a democracy, to understand the whole country sort of united behind a particular leader, or at least it, saying that they are. But it's always been bigger than the individual himself. Is that right?
It's the concept of the great leader. And great leader is kind of like a god. So, you know, there's a bit of a personality cult, but he's almost a godly figure. So every building in North Korea, every room has a picture, a portrait of him. There's just no blank wall. Hmm. Every building has, you know, his sayings on every single building, and every song would be, you know, made by him or about him, and every television program, every news item, every newspaper headlines, there is not a single thing that's not about the great leader. So it's almost like a god figure and a father figure at the same time.
So the fact that you had these rules indicates that at least somebody, maybe your minders or somebody, understands that the world is not the same everywhere in North Korea as it is in North Korea. But it seems like your students didn't fully understand that. They, for example, believed that Korean had been accepted by the rest of the world as such a like superior language that it was being spoken as a kind of lingua franca everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think some students were more like that than others, and some were possibly pretending to not know because they were really afraid to admit that they knew, but some genuinely believed that, but also because they've just not been shown anything. You know, if you turn on TV there, it's one note. It's only about the great leader. Their textbook is only about the great leader. And they have these great leader classes every day. And, you know, and they don't ever get shown the images of the outside world. You know, no one could recognize, like, Eiffel Tower or Taj Mahal. They'd never heard of it.
Hmm.
So, you know, I mean, like, just nothing. I mean, the Beatles. I mean, nothing. None of the symbols that we are familiar with in the rest of the world, they know. But they also don't have the internet. They don't even know its existence. So if you just get given no information, also they were 19 and 20, so they were still young. And it was entirely possible in that world where no information comes in from the outside for them to not realize it and only just believe what they're told, which is that the Korean language is so superior, Korean food is the most, you know, envied food in the world. And it was all about them being the greatest in the world.
It's strange to think, Suki, about the experience of adolescence in a place where independence is not valued and where any expression of independent thought is thought to be like a perversion.
Yeah, I mean, that did happen when... So I think my own way of being their teacher, I wanted to impart some information. And I, you know, tried to teach them essay writing, which simply didn't work there. You know, I insisted. We all had to get our lessons approved by the North Korean staff, every lesson. somebody was always reporting on the class. And students, a couple of students were all reporting the class. So you couldn't just teach anything you wanted. But so I submitted a plan for essay. It was approved because I insisted they must learn how to write that. But it just didn't work because they didn't know how to write. You know, essay is all about coming up with an argument, assertion, and proving it. And there's no proof. There's no coming up with your own argument. There's no refutation. There's no introduction. There's no conclusion. Because in their world, there's only one theme allowed, which is the great leader. And great leader does not need proof.
It also seems like science would really collapse in an environment like that, where you really do have to test things and see if they're true or not. And if you haven't been taught to explore intellectually, you're not going to be able to do science.
Well, I think that critical thinking is dangerous to survival in North Korea, because if you were to think for yourself, you would realize everything they're telling you is a lie. And they have been taught lies all their lives. I mean, my students are science majors, computer majors. You know, not that they didn't know the internet, but also they would tell me things like they thought their scientists had invented to change the blood type A to blood type B, and it was hailed as the greatest, you know, invention in the world. Or they'll tell me that basketball makes a person grow taller. That was proven in their world. But there was no way I could argue that, because this is what their textbook said. I mean, their textbook also says it was South Korea that attacked. It was South Korea and the United States that attacked North Korea. And that was the Korean War, which then they won. They actually celebrate a victory day in July. And, you know, you would think that there are Korea's divided, there's an armistice, and that would mean that nobody won that war. Korean War was, you know, never ended. But in North Korea, a victory day is celebrated because they won.
What did you do when you were confronted with these facts? You were definitively not allowed and would have been in great danger had you, you know, refuted these things that you knew to be untrue. I mean, how much self-discipline does it take to just keep your mouth shut and pretend that you're believing all this nonsense that you're hearing?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, there's something really interesting about North Korea, where from the minute you enter, it's not like anywhere else, because they take away your passport and your cell phone and you have a minder. It's just a different system. And so I think you begin to, it's just an odd thing about human nature that for survival, you know you have to go with their system. And there was no way that I could tell them everything about what they're being told is a lie, because I knew that if I did that, I would get deported.
You actually did have some limited access to the real internet, like in the privacy of your own room. Is that right?
Only the teachers.
Okay.
So the students didn't know it existed. But the teachers, it was a monitored connection. Somebody was always, you know, the rooms were bugged and our internet connection was monitored, which meant that we could email home, but somebody was looking at what we were writing. So, you know, I had to come up with a new email address, and I only kept in touch with, you know, one family member who also created a new email address so that, you know, they can't really look through your other stuff.
The students obviously knew that you spoke Korean, but you were supposed to speak with them and they were supposed to speak with you only in English. I wonder if there were times when you could sort of overhear something and they would almost forget that you understood both languages, and whether you picked up on things that surprised you.
That did actually happen once. We were talking about, you know, they all said, I think it was a game of truth or lie. And there was a sentence that said, you know, I think my TA, in the summer semester, I had a TA, and she put a sentence like, you know, I went skiing in New York. Is this true or false? And they didn't, you know, I could hear in Korean, they were all asking each other, what is ski? But then when I asked them in English, they were like, they all said they knew because their country had many ski places. So there were moments like that where I just, you know, I'm like, I heard you. So, you know, but the whole common language thing was an interesting thing because although I was their English teacher and, you know, the only request they made, because we got very close and I really love them. And at the end, the only request they made from me when I asked them, is there anything you want? They asked me if I could speak to them in Korean. Hmm. And I found that, and I thanked them for letting me be their teacher. But it was a very touching moment because although I was their English teacher, I was not even allowed to speak Korean with them. That was the only thing they wanted from me. And I realized it was some sort of a closeness they wanted.
So because we in the West are so kept out of events in North Korea and we hear little snippets here and there, projects, very brave ones like yours, give us a little bit of a glimpse. It's really easy, I think, for Americans to assume, you know, sort of caricatures or that everyone who lives in North Korea that has any power is bad. But I've been thinking about this over and over since reading the book. I mean, the young men that you were teaching are without question, right, the next generation of lower-level leaders within Korea. And I wonder if being exposed to them gave you perspective on the people who are trapped in this system right now that are perpetuating the policies that keep North Korea where it is.
You know, it's such an odd country, isn't it, North Korea? Mm-hmm. And my goal of writing this book was to humanize it because we have no inside account from North Korea other than from defectors. But defectors are writing those when they fled North Korea. So to actually get a real portrait from inside, I thought that what I wanted was to actually deliver a portrait of real human beings, real people. And once we do that, I thought we could look at North Korea beyond all the caricatures. What I did find in my experience there, you know, I've been there 5 times over a decade. But that time of getting to know them, because it's easy to assume in a black and white way, you know, bad guys are evil and they've got all the power and they will live in Pyongyang, in the capital, and everybody else is starving. I didn't find that to be the case because the students I taught had no freedom at all. You know, these are obviously the most privileged young men. They didn't have a single free moment. There was nothing that they could do. It was a system of fear. They all watched each other. They had to all report on each other. Their responsibilities were mapped out from 5:30 a.m. when they wake up until they go to bed. There was just no way for them to think freely. And they were so young, 19 and 20, these beautiful young men. And I felt what that meant was if elite lived like this, this entire country functions on fear. You know, and that nobody, absolutely no one is spared, which is a horrific thought.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jose in Dallas. Hi, Jose.
Hey, hello, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Go right ahead, please.
Question?
Okay.
I'm just curious, since this university is run by fundamentalists, what kind of science are they being taught? Are they being taught creationism? Are they being taught that the world is 10,000 years old?
When I was there, there was no science being taught. It was only, although it was called the University of Science and Technology, it was only English was being taught. I think there are now science teachers, but I don't know what kind of science they're being taught now.
What did they see, what did the North Koreans see as the value of learning English, given that they don't expect to send their elite young men out into the world?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think that is probably a good sign that they see the need for their future leaders to speak English so well. And Mike has really spoken well. But I did often wonder that none of them were allowed out of the country. North Koreans don't travel even within the country without permission. You can't go to the next town on your own. You need a permission. So there's no movement within the country, but also they can never leave. And I did wonder what kind of future. But, you know, when I was there, our minder, his job was to just watch us and like, you know, because teachers were taken on this weekly outing to grocery shopping in the diplomat quarter in Pyongyang. And he would just drive, you know, like watch us there, watch us back. He was an English major from Kim Il-sung University, which is the best university in North Korea. And, you know, that would be like Harvard of North Korea. And I felt like if this is the job he can get, I mean, they don't apply for a job. The government assigns you jobs. But I thought after getting the English, you know, degree from Kim Il-sung University, and I kind of wonder about my students. I mean, are they going to have to, like, you know, watch the report on foreigners? I don't know.
I was surprised that in those shopping excursions, there were at least some establishments that accepted U.S. dollars in payment.
Well, because their currency has no value, but the shops we were taken to were only for foreigners. So, which is why they take dollar and euro and Chinese yuan. And it's because they don't, you know, they just separate the locals from foreigners. So that's why the dollars were used.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Suki Kim. Her new memoir is called Without You, There Is No Us, My Time with the Sons of North Korea's Elite. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Suki Kim. Her new book is called Without You, There Is No Us, My Time with the Sons of North Korea's Elite. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Suki, you were there, obviously, to tell this story about these students, but you were also there to teach them English. And one of the things that you wished was that they could be exposed to more English language media to get a sense for how the language was spoken in a natural setting. Finally, you arranged for them to watch the movie Harry Potter, like the original Harry Potter, which was something that was very exciting, I guess, for them. But I wanted to ask, did they get it, given that the movie really assumes that its audience has kind of a familiarity with, like, Western middle-class aesthetics?
I think it was more a chance to just see a foreign movie. Mm-hmm. They never get to. So I think I was surprised they even knew about it. But they heard it mentioned in the textbook, you know, because they had so little. So if they got one little mention, then they retained that information. So they were so excited about Hermione and Ron and Quidditch, I think.
Oh, Quidditch,
and, yeah. Yeah, Quidditch, the game. And I think they were just, it was just because they just are not allowed any foreign film. And the only ones they have seen were Lion King and March of Penguin, because I guess animation and nature films are not dangerous. Hmm. And, you know, I couldn't actually show Harry Potter because, I mean, that was a scene in the book where the fellow teachers opted for Narnia, which had a Christian theme. So I guess that was a moment when, you know, that would be considered some sort of a subtle influence by showing Narnia. And they really disagreed with Harry Potter.
So to be clear, it wasn't your North Korean minders that had a problem. It was your fellow instructors who were evangelical Christians.
Right. Actually, amazingly, because we had to get them approved, that the North Korean staff approved the Harry Potter movie. But the fellow teachers really had a problem with Harry Potter. So ultimately, I ended up, although I taught two groups of 50 students, I could only show to one group. That was a compromise I had to make to show Harry Potter to them. And they were over the moon, the ones who got to see, of course, my other, it was like a Sophie's choice, my other group of kids could not. You know, I never, but, you know, as fate would have it, the day that we saw Harry Potter, that I only showed it to one of the two groups that I taught, right after that, we got the news that Kim Jong-il died. So I never could follow up on the Harry Potter reaction.
This was like the day before you were scheduled to leave. Will you describe, it sounds like this strange quiet just descended over everything.
Yeah. I mean, we were, you know, that last day, it was literally I was leaving and they were heartbroken I was leaving. And, you know, they kept asking me, are you coming back in the next semester? And over and over and over. And then suddenly they got called away to this special meeting. And then we were told Kim Jong-il died and the campus just remained empty. And the kids went to, there was a Kim Il-sung-ism building in the campus. The campus had, like, Kim Il-sung is the original great leader. So there was a building dedicated to him, which they would go every day to take lessons on Kim Il-sung studies, great leader studies. So that was like a shrine to their great leader, which they also guarded 24/7, no matter what the weather is. Six students stood all night guarding this building. So that's where they all went to when the news was announced. I also must mention the campus had a forever tower of immortality, on which was written, our great leader is eternally with us. So these were, you know, the things you see in every North Korean community is the Tower of Immortality and Kim Il-sung Studies building. But they went to that building and then they just, you know, no longer met my eyes, you know, whoever I saw. And when I saw them for the final time at breakfast, they literally just looked at me without seeing me. And it was this amazingly heartbreaking moment where, you know, I mean, they were so struck with sorrow. You know, the man who had created their world, their great leader, now was gone. So they were heartbroken. But I think, you know, because we'd gotten so close, and yet there was this feeling that the wall was so impenetrable. That was my last impression, because they just no longer saw me.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with David in Richardson. Hi, David.
Hi, Chris. Another great show, as always.
Thank you.
You know, after seeing Frontline and hearing some stories on the radio, it seems like there's two different North Koreas. There's the elite Korea that we're getting a glimpse of here, and then there's the broader Korean community, the masses, which seem to be getting, you know, despite the North Korean regime's attempts to suppress it, seem to be getting trickling effects of more and more exposure to American or just Western culture in general, or pop culture in general. And I'm curious if the guest would like to comment on, you know, what she's seen when she was there and how this divergent, seems like almost two-tier system, is going to ultimately clash, because I think over time, just as it did in East Germany, and it's kind of in the process and in China, you know, Western culture is just infecting everything.
What do you think, Suki?
Well, I think that the frontline things you're talking about is the world of defectors is a particular one because defectors mostly come from the bottom rung of the society. North Korea being a place without a movement, that you can't go to the next town without a permission. So defectors generally end up coming from the borders with China. So those people are far more aware in some sense because things trickle in at the border. And so I think to get a balanced point, because it is such a one particular set of people that end up defecting, are allowed to defect and make it. And, you know, all those Western DVDs that are, it's actually not Western, it's usually South Korean soap operas that get trickled into North Korea, and then North Koreans watch those and see that the world outside is different. And they might trickle into Pyongyang among the rich, but, you know, that would be a far dangerous route to get those things all the way into Pyongyang. And I don't know how much of this two-tier system that's about to crash. I don't know about that because I think North Korea is basically Pyongyang and the rest of it. Very, 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 you know, a minority of rich and then powerful, and then the rest of North Korea is just, you know, dire poverty. So I don't understand how any kind of toppling effect could happen, because I think toppling effect could only happen if you have some sort of grassroots movements or some sort of communication in place, which there isn't.
Is happiness possible if you have no freedom?
I think in light little moments, you know, I think I might have a scene in the book about that, that there were small moments of happiness. Because I think they're so sheltered in a way, there was this incredible purity or innocence, you know, small joy. You know, my kids were one time actually allowed out. They went to the zoo and they just did not stop talking about it. Mm. You know, they were so excited, like over the moon about this zoo. And watching them, it was sad because I was like, what 19 and 20 year olds are so, you know, obsessed with like their day at the zoo? But that's also because they had so little. But also the joy seemed incredible too. So I do think small bits of happiness is possible. However, you know, it is such a horrific system of never having any freedom and never being infantilized. They can't do anything without a permission. So, you know, it is not happiness as we think is happiness.
We have an email here from Tom in Wichita Falls who says, I'm a former ESL instructor. How do you teach idioms and phrasal verbs without discussing cultural values?
Well, that's when I did sort of slip in some cultural values because, you know, sometimes these words would pop up and they would just ask innocently because they didn't know. They're like, what is this thing called tax? Hmm. And another time they asked me about National Assembly, and that wasn't, you know, these are words that popped up in the textbook. So, you know, it was very careful. I mean, this is what was so stressful about being there, because to explain those things without really revealing, you know, or talking about some sort of a political system is very difficult to do. So you're constantly, you know, walking on ice to carefully explain in the most vague way as possible, because you don't want to get that student in trouble.
It had to have been strange for you, even with your colleagues, and I realize that you didn't share religious values, but the other teachers that had come from other countries, surely many of you noticed that things were very strange in North Korea, but you had so little privacy. I gather there wasn't a lot of time to, like, sit on your bed and talk to a new friend about what you were both living through.
I think there was a little bit of that where we compared notes, you know, like, for example, they showed March some teachers showed March of Penguins for, you know, activity day that was planned. And because, although they could have projected the film to the whole wall, they couldn't move those portraits because every wall had the great leader portraits on the wall. And so they could only show to this group of like 100 freshmen to half the size it could have been, the movie. So it's moments like that where we all knew this is the was the way, but, you know, we wouldn't really, it was sort of like we look at each other, can you believe this? And so, but there was a lot of sort of silent understanding of sort of this insanity. Like, why can't we take the portraits down? We can't. Or, you know, move them just while we're watching the movie. Or the fact there is not a single blank space in the whole school. And I think that was basically North Korea to me. There is no blank, you know, every North Korean wears a badge of great leader at all times. And the fact that every building has a slogan of the great leader, you know, it's like every room has a great leader portrait. It really made me feel that it's like, you know, branding, you know, as if it's his. Every single thing in that country belongs to the great leader.
It must be strange for you as a journalist because you did come to care so much about your students and forget about traveling to North Korea again. You cannot, there's no chance, right, that you'll be able to write letters to these young men or call them on the phone or email, nothing.
I think that was a, you know, I think it is an odd feeling, but it was also very particular circumstances. You know, I knew that the only way I could write about North Korea was to be embedded in North Korea, because otherwise you walk away with the government propaganda. So for me to live there and be embedded, I knew if I were their teacher, I would have to write a book. And once they do become the subject, although I protected them in the book by blurring their identities entirely so that they could not be identified, you know, I think that because they belong in my book, in a way, it's an odd thing because there is a distance that gets formed. And yet I felt so, I loved all of them. So there is a sort of, you know, they're like constantly in my heart. And I look for their faces whenever I see any articles, images about, you know, about their age on newspapers.
Journalist Suki Kim's new memoir is called Without You, There Is No Us, My Time with the Sons of North Korea's Elite. Suki, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.